Welcome, podcast listeners, to yet another episode of the best podcast on the Blabbernacle, Rational Faith. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kissel.
And I got it right, didn't I?
You did. It sounds like you're wanting to, you keep wanting to go to the blob. But
there's such a desire deep inside me to go to the Blabbernacle.
What?
But we're the Blabbernacle.
Yeah,
dang it.
Come on.
Nobody else knows about it.
Keeping
That's
it weird on
the
Blabbernacle.
I'll get it one of these days. So the podcast today is one of my favorite subjects ever. The title is An Old Earth, but what that means is I get to talk about geology, as we had discussed in our last at the end of our last episode a little bit. And so, Brian, you were able to listen in ahead of time of this interview with Dr. Janie Radabaugh, who is a planetary scientist at BYU. What did you think of the conversation?
Well, one comment that I did have was that you're always talking about everybody being nerds and stuff. In this episode, Brian nerds out big time. So you can look forward to that.
Yes. Yeah, I get pretty excited about this stuff. For some reason, it just trips my trigger, and I think it's neat. I think it's probably like people that like to watch Cosmos and get excited about that. We start talking about geology stuff, and for some reason, the way the Earth was formed and all the, you know, understanding the mountains around you. I mean, going to school in Utah and studying geology is like perfect because, you know, most of the universities are up against the mountains there. And so you can just look out the window or stand outside and look up, and you can have a geology lesson where most everybody looks at the mountains and they're like, oh, look, mountains with some trees on them, and there's a cliff there, and there's canyons, and, you know, that's kind of the story.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh, look, there's this band of shale that's really crumbly, and then there's a band of quartzite below it, and there's a band of limestone above it. That means blah, 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 blah. And it, you know, that tells you something about how those sedimentary rocks were laid down, that once these rocks that they were being laid down in an ocean, that's where they're formed. It wasn't always a mountain. At one point, those rocks were underwater, and you can tell that the ocean, the sea level rose for some reason. Way back in time, millions of years ago. And so it just, there's all the rocks and the things that you see around you in Utah, they're telling a story. They're telling what the Earth has experienced. And it's just super neat. It's just really cool.
No, it's really cool. Yeah. I'm someone who, like, I never thought it was interesting at all until like after my mission, when I really started to get into college. And but I was raised in this way that it was always kind of mysterious, and you look at those same kind of things. My dad was really big into hiking, and so we would do a lot of kind of camping and going into the mountains and stuff, but that kind of understanding how the Earth kind of came into being was a little confusing, especially because I had this idea that the Earth was created in 6,000 years, and there were these strange little things that didn't really make sense. So I don't know. Hearing you guys talk about it was just really fascinating, and it's interesting to kind of hear people passionately discussing some of the things like this.
Yeah, and I'll point out at some point in the interview, as I think about these sort of things, it gives me this sense of awe. And I describe it as like the feeling of walking into a grand Catholic cathedral, or just a really big building where you feel very small right next to this very large structure. And that's what geology and astronomy does, is you just, and you almost feel insignificant, but it makes you feel amazed at what there is around you. And so that's part of the reason, is there's so much of a story there buried in these rocks of what's been going on, and it just tells so much more. And so for me, some of this science stuff, especially in this area, it almost has sort of a spiritual aspect to it, where
right.
You know, it's like studying church history or whatever, something like that, where you have this grand narrative of all these complex things going on, and maybe in our little after the podcast discussion, I'll nerd out a little bit more. You never know, but anyway, let's jump right in.
That's the incentive to stay and listen to the whole thing, because you'll get to hear more nerding out.
So. Yeah. There's in the blog post, there's some pictures, like there's the one picture, the featured image that's up on the top, and then there's another one, and I'll explain those a little bit, because I think if you just look at those pictures, it's like, oh, there's some rocks there, but I think you'd be surprised to understand why those are so significant, or why what those pictures might be telling. So that'll be the incentive to listen all the way to the end.
Very cool. I'm excited. So let's go ahead and just jump into the interview then.
So on the podcast today, we have Dr. Janie Radabaugh. Say hello to everybody, Dr. Radabaugh.
Hi, everyone. I'm happy to be here.
Great. I'm really excited today because, as I've mentioned in some of the other, at least the Big Bang discussion, I started out in school as a geology student, so I've been really excited to talk about geology, because I just found it really fascinating. I ended up going a different direction, but I think it's a fascinating field to look around at the rocks and look at the Earth and learn how we think it was made. I've always really enjoyed that. So, Dr. Radabaugh, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background, and what made you so interested in geology that you took it as far as you have and became a professor of geology?
Okay. Well, so I'm actually a planetary scientist, and, you know, I don't know if I ever would have just picked that from my youth and headed toward it, but it ends up being the perfect place for me. And the reason for that is I've always been interested in space ever since I was very young, and I've always thought it would be really neat to be able to explore space and explore, I don't know, the solar system and stars and things like that. And so I ended up studying astronomy for my undergrad. And as I was doing that, I realized there's actually a whole field called planetary science, where you can study planets in the solar system. And the reason the field grew is because, you know, we've been working out in space with robots and with people since about the middle of last century. And so, you know, we have been thinking carefully about how can we learn more about what's going on. And we need tools like geology and chemistry and physics to be able to help us do that. And so as I did that, I started to learn about geology a little bit late, actually. It was after my undergrad, and I did a master's in geology, and it really just felt a lot like home. You know, I could apply these things that I'd seen in hiking outside and, you know, playing up in the mountains, and now I could understand why those things were the way they were, and then apply that to other planets. And so that's what I do. I blend, you know, what we see on the Earth with what we think we see on other planets in terms of geology. And I find the best place for me to be able to do that is to be a professor in geology at a university. And that way I can also interact with students and get them excited about this too.
Well, that is cool. So you had your head in the clouds, and we brought you back down to Earth.
Exactly. That's a good way to think of it.
So that's interesting. Your pathway is a little different than, you know, the typical linear trajectory of someone at 18 knowing exactly what they want to do and going right down the line, but it kind of moved around a little bit, like I have. Like you were saying, I've always enjoyed when I've gone on hikes with friends when I was still studying geology and everything was fresh in my mind, I would explain. I probably bore everyone to death saying, oh, this rock was here, and when these things came from being buried in the ocean, and so the limestone's on top, and the, you know,
yeah.
It's just a lot of fun to walk around and just kind of have an understanding of what things are. Instead of just seeing mountains jutting out of the ground, you can look at the color and see what kind of rock it was and, you know, what things you might find or won't find in there. So
yeah,
I've always found it super fascinating.
It is. I had a kind of a neat moment. My family's had a place down near Capitol Reef National Park in Utah.
Mm,
and
yeah.
Ever since I was, baby. And so I've gone there and spent most summers down there. And I was hiking around in Capitol Reef and I realized I was standing on huge fossil sand dunes, and littered across those sand dunes, you know, fossil dunes were, big boulders of basalt rocks. And I realized, I study sand dunes on Saturn's moon Titan, and I study lava on Jupiter's moon Io. And they were both there all along, you know, right in front of me. So so that felt a little bit like a meant to be moment. I don't know.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so.
Few people, unless they've taken a fair amount of geology classes, they know that geologists look at rocks, and they probably work for an oil company or something like, or the USGS, they make maps or something like that. But let's talk a little bit about geology as a discipline and what is studied in geology and really the development of it, because some of the huge developments in geology that have helped us understand how the Earth is working happened in the 20th century.
Sure.
So one of the early principles, if I remember right, that shaped geology the way it is today, is the principle of uniformitarianism.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about uniformitarianism and how that made sense of the rocks on the ground compared to the previous notion of catastrophism.
Yeah, it's actually got a nice story, and we were able to think about that in some detail a couple of years ago. We went to England for a history of geology field trip, and there were, you know, four geology professors standing out on a place called Sicker Point in Scotland. And this is a place where James Hutton, kind of thought to be the father of modern geology, where he stood and he looked there and he saw, first of all, he saw, you know, layer upon layer upon layer of rocks in one orientation, and then he saw a whole bunch of other layers kind of stacked vertically next to each other, and then a whole bunch of others on top of that, whole sequences of rocks. And then at the same time, he looked over at the ocean and he saw waves lapping up on the shore and bringing really small amounts of sediment and depositing sediment and then rolling back out to the ocean and really slowly depositing the sediment. And it occurred to him, each one of those layers formed over a really long period of time. And then some of those layers were, you know, hardened in some way, and then some were tilted by some other process and then eroded, and then some other layers were laying down on that. And so it occurred to him, he's looking at the evidence of the fact that this process has gone on for eons and eons. And in fact, we hadn't even been thinking about anything beyond thousands of years at that point. And he was saying, okay, now we're even looking at maybe millions, and maybe even there's no vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end. And so he was almost looking at limitless time. And that idea is just that, okay, this, we need to look at what's going on here on the Earth and look at the processes that are happening and assume that those same things are what built the geology that we see today. And some of the things we see just are very, very old, and it's hard for us to keep those numbers in our mind. So that's where the idea of uniformitarianism came, and it really revolutionized our way of thinking about the Earth and the age of the Earth and the time frame of processes. And it helped prepare us for our realization, once we finally had age dates from meteorites and the surface of the moon, that the Earth is actually 4.567 billion years old. And before that, there was just no comprehension of that as a possibility.
What time period was Hutton when he came across this outcrop and noticed all this that you just described?
This was mid-1800s, I believe.
Okay.
So it was a while ago. You know, we really had, after that, we had some time to think about this and really come to grips with that understanding and start having a really serious discussion. And so that's where geology has been for a while.
Yeah. And so, as you said when you were describing it, there's a decent-sized assumption built into the principle of uniformitarianism, and that is that the processes that we see now, that we see deposition, we see erosion, we see rocks forming or sediment being laid down or volcanic eruptions happening, that those types of events have happened fairly constantly, or at least as we see them now, that's how things have always shaped the Earth. And that's very different than the catastrophism. Why is it that we feel good making this assumption versus saying that catastrophic events, such as Noah's flood, for instance, that from a biblical sort of antiquated view of geology or a view of the Earth, would say that there were catastrophes that shaped the Earth and then it was relatively constant?
Yeah.
Why does uniformitarianism continue to make more sense, or we feel more comfortable with it than catastrophism?
Well,
because either way, you're extrapolating and saying, well, I think that everything was fairly constant, and the other group is, and it's just been a really, really long time, and the other side would say, well, I think there were very specific events that shaped the Earth, and the Earth really isn't that old.
Exactly. You know, one thing I do need to mention is that Hutton made his discoveries in the late 1700s, so it was even earlier. You know, it's very interesting actually being a planetary scientist, because it turns out that catastrophism has a role to play, and it's a very important role, that we can look at what's going on the Earth, and we can look at, for example, big sequences of limestone that I can look at on the mountains right next to my house here in Utah, and I can see those, and what makes the most sense is, okay, if I look in the Bahamas right now, there are carbonate rocks being very slowly laid down by, you know, little critters dying and settling to the ocean floor, or, you know, just chemistry going on in the ocean that ends up laying down layer after layer of rock, and it takes a very long time. Now we can see the evidence behind us up here in the rocks. So those just make sense for that particular process. But when we look, for example, at the Earth's moon, and we try to understand why does the Earth have a moon, we can't use uniformitarianism to describe that. We actually have to use catastrophism. We have to say the reason there's a moon there, and what makes the most sense in terms of all of the evidence put together, is that a large body the size of Mars came and smashed into the early Earth, and out of that massive catastrophic collision arose the Earth-Moon system. And there is no better explanation that we can find right now. So
and that event had significant impact on the way the Earth is, like with the seasons. Don't they think that the impact caused the Earth to have an axis that's offset?
It at the very least, what it does is it helps stabilize that the tilt of the Earth, so that you can have you know, an Earth maintain that tilt over long periods of time, which helps with the seasons being more constant. And enabling long processes like evolution to take place in a comfortable way. If the axis can tilt, you know, vary in its tilt, then you might have a lot more sort of global coverage of ice on the Earth called snowball Earths and other events like that. So it helps, actually. It helps a lot in terms of making it a good place for life to be. But so it's true. We have to look at each individual situation and circumstance and piece of evidence to decide what is the best explanation for this particular event here. And it turns out for most of the time, even for building giant mountains and for carving deep valleys and for creating bedrock layers, most of the time uniformitarianism works out the best. But we do have to look around and say, okay, what could explain this? Well, how about a big catastrophic volcanic eruption? And again, there are lots of volcanic eruptions, so you could almost still put that in uniformitarianism camp. But for that particular location, you know, all of a sudden, all the vegetation disappears, you know, above that layer for a little while because of a big volcanic eruption or a big meteor impact that deposited lots of material and caused the decimation of life for a while on the Earth. And so we have to look at the different situations and decide that.
And it sounds like you're referring to the KT boundary. At least that's an example of a catastrophic event that shaped the Earth.
Exactly. yeah, we have very good evidence for a massive impact that occurred 66 million years ago. And we've even found the location of the crater, which is over 100 kilometers across, so, you know, 70 miles across. And it's in the Yucatan. And this event, we find debris from this event all around the Earth. It was a massive event. And it looks like it actually did in the dinosaurs. You know, they were pretty comfortable up to that point. And then in the rock record, we just don't find evidence of them above that, basically, or later than that in time. And so that's again, the best explanation we have right now for why that massive change occurred. And that was another example of catastrophism affecting things. But as we look at modern events, much of the time we consider still, you know, how do we form the Grand Canyon, for example? Well, the Grand Canyon formed over millions of years of constant, slow, steady erosion, like we see still happening today by the Colorado River slicing its way down through the Colorado Plateau in order to create the Grand Canyon. And there's no reason to assume that that process isn't what formed the Grand Canyon in the past. It just has taken a long time to get to be the way it is now today.
Great. Those are excellent examples of the way the two camps make sense of different events. The interesting thing about early geology is that it's based on plain logic. Like there's this set of principles. Was it Hutton that wrote that early textbook, or was there another early geologist that had like these nine principles, like principle of superposition, original horizontality?
Right, I believe that might have been Charles Lyell.
Ah, yeah, I think that might be right. But it's interesting that they were just making sense of what they saw before them in this age of reason. And, you know, they figured it's laid down, the sediments are laid down on the ground like you see in a lake bed or in the ocean. And so if you see bands of rock that are vertical, then you know at one point it had to be originally horizontal, and then something happened where it was tipped upwards.
Yeah.
And so they had little hints and they knew strange things were happening in the Earth, but they didn't know what was driving this disruption of the original horizontality, or was driving the metamorphic rock changes and mm-hmm. things like that. And yep. So if I remember right, that didn't come around until either the 40s or the 60s. Can you tell us a little bit about the experiments where they started to see the seafloor spreading and understanding tectonic plates?
Yeah, so actually early in the 1900s, Alfred Wegener, and there were others, I can't think before him and kind of at that time, but he really put this idea forward that, okay, look, the fit of the continents is just too good, and it's even better if we look off into the continental shelves, which are buried by water. They just fit together way too well. So it's likely that at some point in the past, the continents were all together and then they've rifted apart. And so the problem that existed there is, well, there's no mechanism for that. You know, the physicists were upset about it. They said, what are you talking about? You know, you can't, and I forget if it's him. I think it might have been someone else who came up with the idea. Well, they just sort of plow their way through the ocean floor, which is solid basalt rock. And the physicists were saying, you can't do that. There's just no way. Even, you know, geologists were mad. Everybody was mad because there was no mechanism for this. And so, later it's actually around the 1950s. It was during the Korean War, and there were ships that were towing magnetometers behind them, for the purpose of looking for submarines. And as they were doing that, they were building up, what the pattern of the magnetic field was underneath these magnetometers. And those instruments would record the strongest magnetic field in the area, which, you know, if there was a submarine, it'd be that. But otherwise, it ended up being the rocks of the ocean floor that had been magnetized by the Earth's own magnetic field. And what they noticed is that there was a really regular pattern in those rocks that indicated, well, sometimes the magnetic field pattern in those rocks is oriented straight north, and other times it's oriented straight south. And then that pattern was mirrored around the giant ridge system that exists in the ocean floor, this huge kind of mountain range that is the longest mountain range on Earth. It runs through the Atlantic Ocean, around the Southern Ocean, up into the Pacific. It's this huge continuous ridge, and that striping pattern was mirrored across that ridge. And so then, all of a sudden, people started to think, okay, actually, now what we're looking at is that at these ridges, and we know there are volcanoes at the ridges, there's new material coming up from deep down below the ocean floor, down in the Earth's mantle. It's coming up, and as it is molten, the little iron particles can orient themselves according to the Earth's magnetic field. And then as they cool, that field is frozen in place, and then it moves away from the ridge, making room for the new rock that comes in. And so now you have this pattern of striping. And then the other thing they noticed is, well, I guess what happens is that Earth's magnetic field flips from time to time. Sometimes it's pointed north, sometimes it's pointed south, and we have the evidence sitting here in the rock for that. So now we have new rock being created at ocean ridges. And so people said, wait a minute, that means the whole ocean floor is moving. It's not just continents moving through the ocean floor. It is the entire crust of the Earth, from ocean floor to continents, the top of the mountains, the entire thing moves. And so now that was the birth of plate tectonics.
I think that story is so neat because the original idea of that Wegener had of having the continents fit together, to me this, I'm going to sound really providential, but that's just kind of how I think about this, yeah. That if it weren't for all the mariners earlier mapping out the world and exploring and trading throughout the sea and having these maps, Wegener never could have noticed. I mean, when you're on a ship, you're just not going to know. You're not going to look out and see, oh, South America fits right into the armpit of Africa or wherever
exactly.
It goes.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to be able to see that until you have the maps. And so we have these maps that have been generated for a completely different purpose, and then we notice, oh, my goodness, look at this. There's something going on here where the continents at one time were close together. And then, for a completely different purpose, we notice that there's these bands of alternating magnetic fields.
Yeah.
And then that gives us a radically different understanding just a couple decades ago of how the Earth changes over time and what plate tectonics are, and now we have a mechanism for what causes earthquakes.
Yeah.
And so I just find this whole human endeavor of not just science, but all the other things of collecting data and then looking at it and just learning more and having a richer understanding of what's going around. So I think that's a great illustration of science isn't going to do things on its own. Mm-hmm. It's standing on the legs of economies all sorts of other history that we've already other people that have gone forward and done other things.
That's a really nice way to think of it. Yeah, and I think actually it's fun that here's something that is very important from the standpoint of Earth's geologic history, or just the whole history of the entire Earth. This is a truth that exists about the way our own planet is. And we're sitting there riding around on these plates and we don't even know it, and up until we figured it out. And I think it's nice that it doesn't matter that it's truth. We still need to go out and seek it and do all those things that you mentioned to try to put together a story. And until we do that, we're not going to really understand what we're seeing anyway, because like you say, we have to build it on all of our experience and all of our understanding in order to really recognize it for what it is once we finally see it.
Yeah, that's it. It just makes you wonder, what other things are going to be discovered sometime soon or in the future based on data we're collecting inadvertently right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really fun to think about and see how these stories have developed. Now that we've got a couple hundred years hindsight, we can say, oh, look how bright we are. We understand all these things.
That's true.
And one other thing, I remember explaining this to one of my little brother's friends, and he was a really bright kid. He ended up you know, going on a scholarship and getting a physics degree and other things like that. Really, really bright kid. And I explained this to him, and he says, so are you saying the Earth is expanding? Because if you have the seafloor spreading, is the Earth getting less dense and it's expanding? And I said, no, that was one of the, you know, it has to go somewhere. It's like this conservation of mass, you know, within the Earth as a system. And so you also have these subduction zones, like the west coast of South America is the obvious one.
Yeah, that's right. That's bright of him to think of that, you know, like, oh, how do you take that up? How do you, you know, make sure that the Earth either, you know, that it's not expanding? And you know, that was the final piece in the puzzle that had people kind of hung up, is, okay, well, you've got all this spreading, but what are you doing with the ocean floor? Yeah. What's happening? And I always tell my students this story because it always takes an open mind, a new bright mind to be able to come to this. And, you know, it's old sage professor was looking at some seismic data, actually velocities of waves as they travel through rocks. And he couldn't understand why there was a increase in velocity and then it dropped back down, and then another increase below that and then it dropped back down, and they continued. And because it should increase if it's really dense, cold rock, and then decrease if it's warm and kind of plastic rock. And so we'd understand, well, if you just have a crust with a little bit of mantle underneath it, then you should have that increase and a decrease. But what's the second increase there? And the graduate student came up and said, oh, well, that would work if you just had one plate underneath another. And so then the professor said, oh, that's what's going on. There's, you know, one plate is actually diving down into the mantle, and we couldn't imagine how to do that either. The mantle's very dense and rigid, and how do you actually plow crust down into the mantle? And until we saw that happening, we couldn't understand how you would do it, and now we can understand it.
Yeah. That's really cool. And it just, I remember hiking up. I was hiking. I went to Weber State, and I would every once in a while in the winter, I think I screwed up my schedule really bad. And so I would just go hiking around, because I took like an early morning class and then a late night class. So I had nothing to do in the middle of the day and couldn't get a job in this really crazy schedule that I had generated. So I'd go hike up. And I remember looking at, once you're up on the mountain, you can really see the Wasatch Front. It's just like, it's just been chopped. I mean, the mountains really rise out of nothing. And I was just thinking, man, think of the forces. And as you were describing the subduction zone of like pushing crust down into mantle, which is very dense material, like I just can't imagine all the energy generated in the core that we understand to be driving all of this geologic activity. It's just phenomenal. And then you get into astrophysics stuff, and this is like minute little bits of energy compared to supernovae.
Yeah, inside our star and everything. Yeah,
exactly. It's just crazy to think about the length of time and the amount of energy that's being transferred in different things. So I just really like thinking about this stuff, because it just blows my mind every time.
Yeah.
So geology, I think I've established geology is a really fun thing.
True. Very.
But let's talk about radiometric dating. Okay. So we've talked about geology, and some of the really bad jokes about geologists are, when someone learns about radiometric dating and this is what geologists do, they say something like, oh, so you're saying geologists actually date?
Nice.
And, oh, yeah, that's
sometimes
funny.
Sometimes we do.
But radiometric dating was like the nail in the coffin, as far as I understand it, to the young Earth hypothesis, or the young Earth idea. Because it demonstrated, like I think you mentioned early on, we found meteorites and rocks that were brought back from the moon, and measured their date using their creation date using radiometric dating, and they were much, much older than a few thousand years or even a few million years. They were 4.6 billion years old. So let's talk about that radiometric dating, that process of understanding when a rock was formed and how old it is.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I know there are better examples than this, but I kind of like this one. Broadly, how we think of radiometric dating and why it works so well in terms of giving us something that we have confidence in is, you know, you say, well, you're looking at a clock, but what if the clock is faulty? But the problem is that I'm looking at millions of clocks, and they're all made by different clock makers, and all of them are telling me the exact same time. And it's kind of hard to, you know, in that analogy, it's really hard for you to say, well, every one of those clockmakers built that clock incorrectly, but they all built it incorrectly the same way to give us the same age. And so that it helps to strengthen this idea that no matter how we look at it, these systems tell us these ages. And so it's hard to refute. And so the idea behind it is that some atoms are so big that they're unstable. They have just too many neutrons sitting in there, and they can't hold themselves together, and so they break apart. And they do that on a statistically regular basis. So it's a little strange. Like this atom that you're holding in your hand could disintegrate now, or it could disintegrate 9 billion years from now. But if I put millions of those atoms all together in the same pile, then a given atom will behave. So like an element like a uranium, and the unstable version of uranium will decay on such a predictable scale, such that I believe for uranium, the half-life. So that means you're holding millions of uranium atoms in your hand. Half of those will decay or break apart in 9 billion years. And then you watch it for 9 billion more years, and half of those will have broken apart. And you watch it for 9 billion more, and half of those will have broken apart. And that is absolutely testable and repeatable for any system that you have. And there are many different examples of radioactive elements. There's uranium and potassium and rubidium and all kinds of those things that decay on timescales that we can measure and we can watch. So you might say, well, 9 billion years, we can't watch something for that long. But we've got millions of atoms sitting in our hands. And so that means that we can tell what that half-life is just by watching for a little while. And we'll be able to tell that. So then the nice thing about that is, well, every rock that we have holding in our hands, and especially rocks that come from volcanoes or from deep inside the earth, somewhere like that, contain some amount of those elements. And so we can take that rock, and if we know that that rock has been isolated, it hasn't been, you know, melted or mixed with any other rocks that are younger, and we have to make sure of that. If we do that, then we can tell just how old it is. And so the very oldest rocks we've found anywhere in the solar system, and these come from meteors that fall down into the earth and sit on the surface as meteorites, those very old rocks ended up being 4.6 billion years old, as you said. And this, again, was around the 50s when we finally figured out this age dating technique. And so then we thought, okay, 4.5 billion years old, but we don't have any rocks on the earth that are that old. The oldest ones we have, you know, at the time were only 3 billion years old, something like that. Now we have some that are 4 billion, and even some minerals that are 4.4 billion. But up until then, we hadn't seen anything close to 4.6. So one of the big goals of the Apollo program to go to the moon was actually to go there and pick up a piece of the lunar crust and see, okay, well, the moon looks very, very old. So am I going to be able to find out, you know, from this crustal rock, the same age that I got from the meteorites? And indeed they did. They found 4.6 billion year old rocks from the lunar Highland crust. And so that really told us the answer. And that was 1972.
And that's another reason why they think the moon collided with the earth when the earth was very, very young. Right,
that's part of it, yeah. Although we think if we went to find the very oldest rocks on Mars or the very oldest rocks on Mercury, we would also get 4.6 billion years old. But that age combined with the fact that the chemistry of the rocks is very similar to the chemistry of the Earth, and it's nothing like the chemistry of Mars rocks, nothing like the chemistry of meteorites. And so that tells us that we're very intimately linked.
Oh, okay. I just want to put a little bit of structure on this, where you talked about you've got a sample of uranium metal that's been concentrated, and so you've got a lot of these unstable uranium atoms that are giving off alpha particles or whatever okay. It is they emit, and you have what's it called, the that measures the count that counts
Geiger?
The
Geiger counter.
Yeah, Geiger. Yeah, yeah. You've got your Geiger counter there, and it's counting up. It gives you a rate. And the way that fits is the half-life behavior that you described as a special type of exponential decay that fits a fairly simple function,
mm-hmm.
and you have to. There's this constant that goes into the equation, and when you have this number counted from your Geiger counter and you get this rate constant, you put that into the equation, and as I understand it, they have samples they have uranium samples that they've been counting for a very, very long time, and this constant isn't changing. It's not waving back and forth. It's like pi or one of these irrational numbers where you just keep getting further and further out in the decimals.
Yeah.
And so it really is a constant. It's not like this crazy erratic phenomenon that's going on. It's becoming more and more predictable over time as the Geiger counter sit there and gather more and more data.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not going away. It's not like this. It's not getting more and more questionable, or it's not staying at some level of certainty. It's getting more and more certainty
precise.
As we collect more
yeah,
and more data,
right.
More and more precise. Correct.
Precise.
Yeah. So, and then you mentioned a bunch of the different atoms that will decay, and there's also different methods that don't have to do with radioactive decay. There's tree ring dating and ice core dating as well. And if I remember right, the short-term radiometric standard is carbon-14.
Yeah.
And they're able to match up dates with tree rings and ice cores that make sense. And then the carbon dating system can match up with all these other radiometric dating systems. Do I have my story correct here, or...
Yeah, that's right. You know, most of the systems that we talked about before with uranium and potassium and rubidium, thorium, those things are very long-term, have long-term decay rates. And so those can help us understand things like age of the Earth, age of a mountain, age of a rock body, that kind of thing. But we are often really interested in more short-term ages. And so when we look at things like tree rings or ice cores or lake sediments, then we can look and say, okay, every season there is a new deposit. So this gives us an annual record of what's going on. And you're right, occasionally in, for example, ice cores, we can find a layer where there's some volcanic ash. And that's just perfect to have this volcanic ash in there, because now we can take the little rock particles that are contained in ash and use the radiometric dating to help calibrate where those things are, and then say, oh, yeah, we were right. We had the right number of layers, and that correlates with how many years and things like that. So that's useful. And then, like you say, we might also use, if we have the right circumstances, we might use carbon dating, because carbon has, for example, carbon is found in things that are interesting to us, like biologic materials or in things like fires that we might have, lit as a civilization or something. And then on top of that, carbon has a very short half-life, the unstable version of carbon, which is carbon-14. And it decays over 5,700 years, 5730, something like that. And so that means that this is short-term. We can do things like study people more easily, study biology, study, when were people last in this area? What kind of things were they eating, whatever it was, and how long ago was that? So the carbon dating is what helps us with very short term, and we compare that with the tree rings and the ice cores.
Yeah, so, I mean, all these methods, it's, sometimes you hear skeptics from some crazy place. You hear skeptics saying, oh, well, radiometric dating, those atoms. There was a guy that was a young Earth creationist that gave a lecture at Weber State when I was there. And I think his argument was, Well, the atoms in the lab where they measure these things behave differently than atoms
in real life
out in the earth in the rocks. And I just thought, what? But I guess maybe if we apply that kind of thinking, then we shouldn't do anything in hospitals, because biological systems, once you put them in a hospital, they're probably going to behave differently. So
that's funny. That's
yeah, I mean, it's just strange that this is so problematic for some a certain type of religious thinking that wants the earth to be young, wants the Bible to be literal, and definitely not all Mormons are that way. There, I mean, all the geology professors at BYU and all the other science disciplines likely are not biblical literalists. Mm-hmm. But in church, we have some people that have more of a fundamental strain to the way they approach scripture and the way they view science, and they're a little skeptical of science. So when you hear scriptures, when people talk about Noah's flood or they talk about the age of the earth, and we get the creation stories in the temple or in the scriptures in a couple different places, and we have Doctrine and Covenants 77, verse 6, where we're told that the earth is 7,000 years old or something along those lines. What do you think about those scriptures? How do you approach scripture in general as both a Mormon and as a scientist?
Well, you know, we never really have been scriptural literalists, as you say, as Mormons. And the reason for that is that we have a number of different accounts of similar events. We have the additional books of Moses and Abraham and Pearl of Great Price that help us that kind of enrich our understanding of certain situations. And what that's done for us is helped us understand, well, all of these accounts are descriptions of events or, in the case of the creation, for example, description of events by prophets who are writing about that event to help us understand what's important for us to learn from that scenario to help us, increase in our spirituality and our closeness to God. And so it's not really necessarily important that the story is exactly right from a material world standpoint. But instead, I think that we often interpret scripture from both a kind of physical standpoint, but also a spiritual standpoint. And I think that helps to encompass events like the fall. And also, basically the creation of Adam and Eve and their relationship to each other. And we never have thought that Eve comes from a physical rib of Adam. That's a figurative discussion. And that's always how that's been interpreted. And Spencer W. Kimball discussed that early on. So it wasn't important for us to think that Eve came from an actual rib. It also has never been important for us to think that the plagues of Egypt covered the face of the whole earth, and yet it's described that way. Does that mean that there were locusts, in Nepal as a result of that? No. They only need to cover the face of the whole earth as concerned the people of Egypt in that location. And so that's been easy for us. And so then taking that and extrapolating that or applying the same idea to something like Noah's flood covering the face of the whole earth. And that's also not a requirement. I mean, why would this have to affect people who live very far away from this wicked civilization? There's no reason for that. Instead, there's this wicked group that is being accounted for in the scriptures, and then Noah's group that's also being accounted for. And that is a group that you would imagine needs to be affected by a flood. And so then you could say, well, that could just exist in that one location. And when we think about scripture in that sense, well, what's the purpose of this account? And if instead we do that, then I think we end up having a greater understanding.
So have you ever had a family member or ward member that really wants to push a Bible as history, Bible as the way things really are, either when you're in a Sunday school class or something like that, or have you not really experienced that?
I think it's tempting for us to do that because in some ways it's maybe easier. It's easier to just read something and literally interpret it. But I honestly don't think that we have done that as Mormons traditionally. I believe in the early 1900s, we started some dialogue with more fundamentalist religions. And so we might have started to interpret scripture in their method. We never did that earlier. We never did that with the founding prophets of the church. And I think we have done better in more recent years at not doing that either. So, you know, another example of that is actually when we look in the Pearl of Great Price, and the phraseology used there is instead, and the, you know, they're described as phases of time and not as years. And so that makes, there's more leeway. You know, we don't need to have this be an exact year, or needs to be thousands of years or whatever, but instead it's a length of time. And so then you can go back and say, well, then why was year used? Well, year is something that I can put in as a placeholder for time. And I don't have to interpret that literally. This is prose to help us recognize truth where it exists, but also to provide a lot of breadth and leeway in terms of the way we understand the actual physical events.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're trying to give the scriptures more plasticity or flexibility. And I think, you know, you mentioned having discussions with fundamentalism in the early 20th century, and that would be Joseph Fielding Smith and the classic debates between Joseph Fielding Smith and James Talmadge about evolution, and he outlived James Talmadge, so we got Man, His Origin and His Destiny published. And, you know, when you have a book published by a prophet, it's kind of hard to say, like, oh, he doesn't really mean that evolution's evil. You know, it makes it harder. I mean, I'm, you know, this is the story that I shared about going to this institute instructor, and he said, no, there was no death before the fall at all. You know, and there's these ideas that were borrowed from young earth creationists or biblical fundamentalists, that the dinosaur bones were from other planets that God used to form the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, putting planets together, that just, fossils wouldn't survive that right. sort of an event.
Yeah, actually, I was just having a conversation today with a number of Mormon astronomers and, you know, and me as planetary scientists working at BYU. And, you know, all of us were talking about how this cloud of gas and dust that we arose from in our solar system was a really complex and kind of violent place, and that processes happening in this fluid were just really difficult for us to even understand now in the modern age of physics and astronomy. There are many unanswered questions concerning that. And so that's really fun. It's really fun to have that conversation and recognize we're well beyond that idea of, oh, well, maybe we could just have had layers from other planets. No, absolutely not. And in fact, but that stems from this original concept that came from Joseph Smith that I think was really bright and perceptive, which is that the, you know, what our planet was created out of was material from other planets, essentially, and, or other objects that existed before. And it turns out to be true. That's the right idea. But just the way we interpreted it early on was not correct. And that means that we always gain more when we keep ourselves open to the idea that, you know, if we do not rigidly apply our understanding of scripture to the scripture, then that leaves room for a lot more depth of understanding and a lot more richness that can exist in the scriptures, as long as we don't misapply them.
Yeah, and that's the way I try and approach the scriptures, is understanding that, you know, I mean, we have a high regard for what we call revelation, and often scriptures are regarded as revelation that was received at some earlier time and then written down. And all of that revelation, any revelation, is filtered through some human's mind, and their culture, their education, their understanding is going to shape that.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, are you familiar with Adam Miller?
No.
Okay, so he's a Mormon philosopher, and he wrote a really good book
that I've talked about on the podcast before called Letters to a Young Mormon. And it's it's a very short book. It's like 75 pages, and each page is half the size of a normal page. You can fit it in your shirt pocket. But it's really nice. It's obviously, as the title, it's Letters to a Young Mormon. So it's these thoughts that he really wants to transmit and explain to his children, and specifically one of his daughters, I believe. And at one point, he refers to science and all the discoveries that are raining down on us as a form of revelation. And that the discoveries that are happening all around us, mitochondrial Eve, radiometric dating, you know, all of this stuff, we should incorporate and be able to rethink our theology, rethink the scriptures. And like you're saying, maybe Joseph Smith had this really clear idea, or at least the germ of an idea about creation not being from ex nihilo or out of nothing, but being organized, the earth and the solar system and the galaxy being formed from other bodies. And rather than misinterpreting that, let's not just take our scriptures, but let's take other information that we have around us and take a holistic approach to interpreting the world and to finding meaning, which I think that's, in my opinion, the main purpose of scripture is to find meaning and to inspire. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I have no thinking in my mind that the authors of the Old Testament were actually thinking about literal events that shaped the earth as we know it, but they were thinking and describing in two different ways, if we read Genesis carefully, that the earth is a gift from God for us to live on. And, you know, they described it in the ways that they did for various reasons. And if we, you know, if we study the scriptures closely, we can see the structure that's in the one account and the very intimate version of creation that's in the second account. So anyway, I'm rambling. I do this from time to time.
Interesting.
So that's what I wanted to have you on for, is often there's this cognitive dissonance that builds up when we hear one thing at church and we learn another thing at college. And sometimes it's hard to put them together in a productive way, especially like if you're the first person in your family to gain a high education.
Yeah.
Often those that haven't, they can be quite skeptical of science, and they, you know, thanks to some of the writings that have been in the church at different times, there is a skepticism towards science, or a little bit of a fear towards science.
I feel like in general it's getting a lot better with the the newer generations that are coming in. But at the same time, it doesn't always necessarily just move as a whole generation. There's still some lateral transfer up lines, you know, of the way we understand things. And so so it still does take a lot of educating and just helping people understand, look, you know, you cannot deny what's in front of you in terms of, you know, physical evidence for things any more than you feel you can deny what's in scripture. So you've got to figure out a way to make both work.
Yeah. And it takes a fair amount of work to make them work.
Sure.
Is there any other thoughts either about geology or Mormonism in general that you'd like to share at all?
One thing that I think is kind of interesting, and you know, this is just my idea, and I test it out on people once in a while, and I get varied reaction to it. But I feel like, you know, we are being watched out for in many ways in terms of what has happened over the history of the Earth. You know, like you say, that the presence of a moon has been really important for us in terms of life being able to arise. And so that's from a standpoint of evolution and, you know, our origins, that those need to start billions of years ago, and they need that time and that stability to be able to come to this point. And so then what I'm doing is I'm placing an importance or a sort of necessity for a moon in order for us to be here. And certainly that has to be within the plan of the creator. So then you watch a system being built and then maybe near the end say, okay, well, we need to put a moon here because this is going to be their home. You know, and so then you say, well, a moon was meant to be. Okay. And then you could apply that same idea to the impact that killed the dinosaurs back 66 million years ago, because while the dinosaurs are these amazing, beautiful creations, they ruled the earth and they did not allow room for the mammals to rise up, and we came from mammals. And so you might kind of think of it as, okay, let's get back on task here and let's remember what we're headed for. And so then that paves the way for forward for the mammals to come and for us to eventually rise. And so I don't know. I don't know if you can require the hand of the Lord to be there in all of those situations, or if you know, you just look for the systems where those things did work, and that's where you end up you know, placing your own children once the vessel is ready, or whatever it is, however you want to think of it. And I don't know, but I do like to think of the earth as having been special and our solar system as having been special from the beginning. And maybe that's going to be true everywhere, regardless of whether there was life on it or not, because it's still one of his creations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the way you can look at it. I think it's a long time endeavor to put things together and to find meaning and make sense of it all. And that's definitely one way to do it. It's been really fun talking with you. I've enjoyed having you on and talking about geology. I just, in my opinion, we should know everything, at least a little bit of everything, you know. And so, you know, not many people take geology, and
yeah,
they should. And so this little one-hour conversation or half-hour conversation, you know, maybe that'll spark some more people to understand or look into things a little bit more. And, you know, maybe when they go on their vacation to Arches or Moab, they can grab a geology book and learn a little bit more. And it's just, to me, it's similar to standing inside a big Catholic cathedral or standing on top of Mount Timpanogos, and it's just, as you understand more and more, I'm in awe at what is before us.
Yeah.
And so I love this stuff. It's just so neat to think about this. It's just, I mean, the big thing is that it's so much bigger than we are, it's been here so much longer than we have, and that there's something about having stuff that's bigger than you that's just like, wow.
Yeah.
So that's why I like geology, and thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me. It's fun.
So, Brian, did what jumped out at you? You know, what was something new or something interesting that jumped out during the conversation?
So I think the big thing that I was thinking about when I was listening to this interview, and maybe it could have been spurred by some of our previous conversation, was, I think, we as individuals who are heavily involved with the world of like online Mormonism and stuff and having lots of these different conversations, I think often we make a lot of assumptions about certain things. So it's kind of this assumption that if you know, like if you, and depending on who you're listening to, some people are like, oh yeah, if you know geology, that kind of proves scripture's wrong, or it proves all of these different things. But even going beyond that, I think we make a lot of these differing assumptions on what some of these differing claims mean. And what I really liked listening to, and which is kind of surprising, I think it'd be interesting to hear more from her and see if she's, because it sounded like she hasn't really seen a lot of challenges to her scientific understanding. Like, she must not deal with a lot with young Earth creationists, I guess. But she was, I don't know. She was just this, like, she would use language that's a little stronger than I'm comfortable with. Like, the church has always had this particular position, when I would probably say, I think there is really good evidence that leaders have believed this particular way as well, you know. But I don't know. It was really interesting just seeing her approach, as it's not really, doesn't seem like that's been a big deal to her, like, in regards to her faith.
Yeah, it's like those questions never even came up. It didn't ever occur to her that there was a problem, or that there was a potential problem with the different interpretations of scriptures over time.
Right.
Because she's, like us, she's grown up in this later period, and if she had sort of a scientific leaning, then those fundamentalist, literalistic readings of Genesis and other stories, and the quotes that you would get from prophets and different general authorities didn't pop up on her radar for whatever reason.
Right, and to try
or
to
she
make
didn't
my...
consider them credible, and so she didn't bother giving them the time of day or something like that.
Exactly. Like, to try to make my point again, we bring in all of these differing assumptions often, and it, like, one of those assumptions is that if you have this scientific perspective, or if you were really influenced, if you believe in these particular things, if you're really into geology, for example, you're going to have problems with these things. And I think that's important to recognize that that's not everybody's experience. Some people are able to go through their lives learning all of these differing things. Yeah, they'll hear things. She's aware of McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith, and she said that they were being influenced by kind of an evangelical environment, you know. So it's like, I think we make a mistake when we think that our experience is going to be the experience that everybody has, and then we have to push that onto them so that they have our experience, where it's like, it works for, she doesn't seem to have that huge conflict that maybe some of us have seen.
Yeah, I agree. And in the next science podcast that we'll do will be with Steve Peck, and the interview's already happened. It will come out in a couple weeks. But he's one that he's been on By Common Consent, blogged there for a while, and so he's more aware of these common issues that come up with, you know, the science and religion not fitting together so well. He'll share his perspective when we get around to that one.
Definitely. Yeah.
So we teased earlier. So I gotta
yeah, walk us through the pictures.
Bit.
Yeah.
All right. In the episode, Dr. Radabaugh talked about a place where she went in England with some students and other geology people and stood at a spot where a significant shift in geology occurred. And that place is called Sicker Point. And in the blog post, there's a picture of Sicker Point, and there's a sketching of it as the featured image. Sicker Point is a place where you really learn how old rocks are. You learn how they are formed and how they've changed over time. So first we have to talk about how rocks are formed. And there's lots of ways that rocks are formed, but in this case I'm just talking about sedimentary rocks. Sedimentary rocks form through deposition, through the depositing of debris, like sand, for instance. So the mountains are eroded away, and that sand gets put into rivers like the Colorado River, and those eventually make it to the ocean or some other place where it can be deposited and build up in layers. Over lots and lots and lots of time, these layers of
deposits get built up so much that they are thousands of feet thick and that they end up getting squished and they are lithified. They are turned into rocks through burial and high pressure. And that's how you make sandstone. So it takes a long time for all those deposits to accrete or to develop. At Sicker Point, and in the picture shown in the blog post, what you see are different types of rock. You have on top, you can see there's rock that has layers in it that is somewhat horizontal, and it's sitting on top of rock that has layers in it, but the layers look kind of like they would be vertical in some way. And what that is 345 million year old red sandstone lying on top of 425 million year old Silurian gray wacky. You'll notice that there's a huge disparity. There's 120 million years in between those two rocks. One was not just put on top of the other in the natural sequence. So you have to think, the rock was formed through deposition, but the layers I'm seeing on bottom are in a vertical orientation. So in order for them to become vertical, they were buried and turned into rock. There was some sort of tectonic activity, either folded the rocks or simply shifted the entire formation on end. And then that rock was raised up to the surface of the earth where it could be eroded away. And the recorded information in the overlying rocks is lost. And that's why we have that 120 million years that is gone. After being eroded away for approximately 120 million years, the formation is buried again under new material and buried so much that the material on top becomes rock again. And if you imagine all the times that you've gone to the beach or you've gone to the mountains, and maybe you've even looked at historic pictures, and the mountains do not seem to shift, and the beach has not changed in a significant way. It's not 10 feet thicker. It's not 100 feet thicker. You realize that these deposition, the lithification process, the deformation that occurs at depth to rotate these rocks into a vertical orientation, these processes take large amounts of time. That's why this spot is so significant. It's a perfect representation of different geological processes and the large amounts of time that it takes to make what we see on the surface of the earth. So when I see that, and when I see these pictures and different geological formations or erosional features or any sorts of things like this, it starts to tell a story, and I stand in awe at the amount of time that's occurred and all of the history that's gone by in front of these rocks. So to you, this is likely some sort of nerdy geology thing, but for me, it's just fascinating.
All right, so enough geology nerd talk. Brian, what's going on next week?
No, and that was really fun hearing you go off about some of that stuff. I think it's really fun to hear you talk about it. But yeah, so I had the opportunity to talk with Margaret Blair Young and a couple other people. I had Russell Stevenson was on there, as well as Mukon, who her last name's pretty tough, so I won't say it right now. But it was a really fun discussion. What's going on is Margaret Blair Young is starting a film that is about... It takes place in Africa. It's about this this kid from Idaho who gets called to go and serve in Africa, and it's about the kind of tensions that occur between these two individuals. So kind of race is a big deal. But what is really fascinating about this film, and one of the big things that we talk about, is a couple things. One of them is this idea that there are so many different biases and different so much ignorance when it comes to our understanding of Africa. And to be able to tell this story in a way that is in the native dialects is kind of trying to challenge some of these misconceptions It looks like this really complex and beautiful portrayal of this story that isn't being told in a very good way yet. So I think it's a really valuable project that's going on, and you'll really like it. So watch out for that interview.
Look out for that next week, podcast listeners.